John Cryer, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. In the second episode of our Chester Holman series, This Story is a Lie, we got to hear from Chester himself about that night in August of 1991 when Taejung Ho was murdered. And we also got to hear how sisters Deirdre and Tiffany Jones first confirmed his account and then inexplicably reversed themselves, sending a 20-year-old on his first ever day of vacation to prison for life. And with us today is Colin Miller. He's one of the hosts of Undisclosed. He's also an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. Hey, Colin.
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm feeling good today. I'm feeling good. Also with us is Candace Horsey. She is an assistant professor and director of lawyering and the legal reasoning program at Cumberland School of Law. Before that, she was an assistant district attorney in Philadelphia from 2003 through 2008. Welcome to the show, Candace.
Thank you very much.
So you were an ADA in Philadelphia for 5 years. So this whole series of Undisclosed must be just hitting you where you live, I would imagine.
It does. I would like to stress that I was a former DA, and my opinions are just my personal opinions, and I'm not representing the office. So it was. It's very striking to hear the names of people I know and to think about my, like, what I still consider my office in a podcast.
Well, yes. And I mean, that was my first question was, so you have come in contact with some of these people, and I imagine that must be kind of odd for you.
It certainly is. It is, and my first impression of the podcast was really one to be a bit jarring, and I, as you'll hear later, have worked on wrongful convictions as a defense lawyer, and I appreciate that wrongful convictions and problems with the criminal justice system are critically important, but my reaction to the podcast was that, for me, it presented a bit of a more misleading and mischaracterization of the police department and the office, and that, I think, just took me a bit by surprise.
Well, this is a wonderful opportunity for you to correct those things. So what do you think is getting across that shouldn't be?
Well, that certain instances, and I think the Sean Thomas one is a very good example of clearly a case where a person was convicted that had an alibi. He was at the YSC. But what I think should be corrected is that there doesn't seem to be any nefarious intent behind suppressing or hiding that evidence, or sometimes it is a case where the defense lawyer didn't follow up, which is was pointed out, or documents go missing and things happen. And one of the points in that podcast, which I think should be clarified, is that when the prosecutor was questioning whether you had any proof that it was in fact him, and they don't, it's a valid question. In my experience, not when I was prosecuting in Philly, but when I was a prosecutor in Maryland, I actually had to have a person fingerprinted in court to confirm that they were not the person who was arrested. So it's not actually that far-fetched to just say, yeah, there's a subpoena. It says Sean Thomas, but do you know that it was him, the man in the room there? Doesn't seem as if it's the prosecutor out to get them. And that's one of the things that I would like to clear up, because sometimes those types of questions may seem unfair, but are fair.
Mm-hmm. It didn't seem unfair to me when I heard it. It seemed as though it was just a tactic. And I imagine as a tactic, it makes perfect sense. You know, when you're dealing with, an alibi for something, you do have to have some sort of, real proof that it was, in fact, that person there. It wasn't somebody claiming to be that person or, that somebody understood to be that person but may not have been. I'm sorry that that came across, but I think it's a good opportunity to get those things out. Again, we're dealing with, we've been trying to set the context of that time in the show and help people understand why there was a lot of pressure on the prosecutors and the police, why the public was feeling scared at that time. And I hope we've been fair to prosecutors and police during the course of this. Is there any context to that time that you'd like to add?
Well, that was before my time. So as you mentioned, I started at the DA's office in 2003. But as far as high crime and lots of offenses and pressure, as you put it, in 2007, CNN was calling us Killadelphia. So the same types of pressures having a rising, and it wasn't necessarily the homicide rate, because the homicide rate was a bit lower, but the shooting rate was fairly consistent. So shootings where people did not ultimately die, and that was in part due to good medical or trauma care, were still occurring at roughly the same rate, but we still had high homicide rates, high crime, those types of things. But my experience was that we were held to very high ethical standards, and no amount of crime justified a dirty win. We were always told to avoid the appearance of impropriety, moral compass set to due north. No one wants a dirty win. And so sometimes I think that this idea that because bad things were happening, prosecutors were doing bad things to get the conviction, I think is not translating, because that wasn't the case in my experience, but it was the same administration, which was Lynn Abraham.
Do you feel like the police force held themselves to that same high standard?
100%. I worked in other places, and as you'll hear, I also was a defense lawyer out of the country. And without question, as a generalization, now I'm not talking about individual officers, as a generalization, the Philadelphia Police Department was hardworking, ethical, and entirely full of integrity. And without naming names of other places, you can't say that about every other police force.
No, we cannot. I come from New York City, and it was not that was not the case in New York City.
And particularly when I was a young DA, like, and I say a baby DA kind of jokingly, but when I was a baby DA, you would have police officers who they themselves were getting training, or they would keep up with developments in the case law to ensure that they were changing their arrest strategies to conform with developing law. And that, to me, was extraordinary. And like I said, there are individuals who I think sometimes do the wrong thing for the right reasons. However, as a generalization for the police department as a whole, I found them unbelievably straightforward and honest and full of integrity.
So a thing like the Whacker Squad, which sounds like they had a suspiciously high closure rate at the time. So would you classify that as an aberration at the time?
Certainly. And similarly, an aberration that occurred during my time, like I say, I can't speak with knowledge, are the officers who were federally indicted, right? So those officers were a cluster of officers, and I believe in the end, only six. And Philadelphia Police Department has thousands and thousands of police officers. But the fact that it went through special investigations and they were indicted suggests that no one's protecting them. So officers being charged with crimes or officers being removed from the force, I think, speaks to the integrity of the police department, that they do not want bad apples spoiling the bunch. And I, like I said, I can't speak to past decades, but that was not, when you have individual officers, the fact that there were actions taken to root them out, I found a promising and a positive thing.
Yeah. So things like in Baltimore, the gun trace task force that just was convicted yesterday, I believe, for some pretty large scale abuse of the system. To you, that's actually, shows that the system is handling. I mean, obviously, you're not from Baltimore. You're not. I'm asking you to comment on an area that.
But I was a prosecutor in Prince George's County, Maryland. So after Philadelphia, I prosecuted down a bit south of there. But I think any time that you're willing to charge and convict and put police officers on trial, it proves to the public, to the police force, and to the prosecutors who are doing it, that they aren't above the law.
So now you've actually taught, you've taught abroad in England. Now, I'd love to talk about the differences there and here and, you know, what you found.
How many hours do you have?
I know.
So I taught there, but I actually practiced there for several years. So I lived there for 7.5 years after prosecuting, and I actually switched to defense while I was there. And I taught British law students, and I taught American law students who are studying abroad. And one of the things that I taught was a miscarriages of justice class, which was inspired, like, was my outlet for a murder appeal that I had worked on for several years, starting in 2010, of a British client who, for reasons due to their system, is still incarcerated. But that's one of the big differences, is that he's not entitled to an appeal. So you have to ask for leave or permission to appeal, which was refused, even though the evidence is there available from the prosecution that he was not where he was alleged to be at trial.
Hmm. Okay. So you changed over from doing the prosecution side to doing the defense side there.
I did. The reason for that was because the system there was so different. I did not believe that I could be an ethical prosecutor. I was eligible potentially to apply to be there, but I could not have done the job there because of the way that the legal system in England and Wales is set up. And to be like, not to put too fine a point on it, it's essentially like going back in your time machine to 1776 to when we got our Bill of Rights and not having it.
Ah, OK. That
Pretty
would
much,
be a big
yeah.
difference. Well, actually, yeah, I did want to talk to you and Colin about that to some degree, because the American system obviously broke off. Something happened in 1776. I don't remember. But that the American system broke off and started doing its own thing. And so I was curious. So you felt that it was impossible to operate as a prosecutor in a way that you felt ethically, I guess. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
There are things that are ethically. There are things that are legal and accepted and completely normal there that would have me my license taken away in this country.
Really? What, like what type of thing?
So let's start at the First Amendment. So
okay.
First Amendment, we have a right to free speech and that. So there you have a Section 5 of the Public Order Act. If you are in public and you're within earshot of someone who could be alarmed, harassed, or distressed by something that's being said, not if they're directing it to them, not disorderly, that person can be arrested.
Huh. Okay.
So that's a problem.
Yeah.
As a solicitor, I felt, right? As a solicitor, if I spoke out against the system or in any way caused it to caused them to lose confidence in the system, I could be essentially disbarred. I could be struck off, because that is not permissible. So I didn't have freedom of speech as a lawyer practicing there to criticize the system openly.
That's remarkable. Now, do you feel like that leads to an effect that's really bad in terms of, do you feel like that leads them to have no possibility for introspection as a system if people can't speak out about it?
Well, indeed. And there isn't introspection because there's no questioning. There's no rigorous challenge. There are no, I mean, even to the extent that we may disagree about conviction practices and tactics and things like that. But we're allowed to discuss it. We can debate it. I can disagree with you. We can have these things. We can push towards reform. We can say, you know what, this stinks. We should do something about that. But that is not a conversation that occurs there.
Yeah, I was wondering, Candace, I'm thinking you were right over there soon after the UK got rid of double jeopardy and now allows for people to be re-prosecuted. What are your thoughts on that as someone who's been on both sides, the prosecution and defense side?
So that is, of course, like there are so many things that are so anti to our system. So double jeopardy, the right to silence, like the fifth, like our Fifth Amendment right. There was a broad stretch of legislations around that time. The Criminal Justice Act 2003 changed quite a lot. So in addition to double jeopardy, like the right to remain silent, bringing back in a adverse inference. If you remain silent, it can be used to presume your guilt. Those types of things were precisely the things I was most uncomfortable with, because double jeopardy, I believe one shot, one trial, you know, I mean, I'm safe from mistrials and things that are kind of procedural irregularities, but not just. One of the more famous examples there was just some untested evidence of a boot of a person who was acquitted. They decided to test it later. It was always in their possession, so not after discovered. And they just retried the person.
Okay.
And convicted them. So, and that was fine because it was allowed. And so it's those kinds of things where I had like very regular personal freakouts about various practices. But I was the outlier. I was the only person who felt that way because I was the only one with the experience of it being entirely different.
Do you feel like there are parts of their system that actually function better than ours?
Yes, there are. So youth and juvenile procedures, I think, are far better. I think that the way that they handle youth, vulnerable and mentally ill individuals, is potentially better. I also believe pretty strongly in the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, which I think has quite a bit of merit. There are a few things that I think we could learn from and that we could do a bit better with in terms of treating kind of things holistically. So, for example, with youth, you they have youth offender teams, which are kind of almost wraparound services to look at the whole family, to look at what's going on, what's causing the offending behavior, not just go to an offender center, like the equivalent of juvie, don't address the home life, let the person out, go back home, and then the cycle begins and carries on. So those types of things, I think, are really important, particularly before you get into a cycle of adult offending.
So given the differences and the things that, as you said, gave you some ethical qualms about being a prosecutor, do you feel like they get it wrong on a fairly regular basis? Or do you feel like, you know, despite that, the system still mostly works?
No, because and I think this is also important to this conversation, is that fundamental to the differing view is, what is justice? What is the system designed to do? So their intention for what the system is designed to do, I think, works perfectly well. What we believe justice and our system is designed to do is a different definition to theirs. And when I do professional development training, so not teaching law students, but when I do continuing legal education for judges or other practicing lawyers, one of the things I ask is, what does Lady Justice look like? And Americans describe Lady Justice, well, I'll ask you, what does Lady Justice look like?
Blindfolded. She's holding the scale. Okay. She's wearing a nice robe. She's wearing a very nice robe.
Where does she hold the scales? Like, what's her body position?
I think she holds them kind of high. The idea being, I guess that the balance of justice is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
He said, guessing.
Does she have any kind of weapon?
Oh wait, didn't she? Does she? She has like this cool laser. No. does she have a sword? Yeah, because she has a sword and scale. Yes. There we go.
And where's the sword?
In the other hand.
What? Where? Where? Like, what's its position?
Oh, you know what? I don't remember.
Right.
I'm guessing
so
about a lot of this, Candace.
Right. So my point is this. You're not really, the sword isn't prominent. You're aware that her scales are up, and you're certain she has blindfolded, correct?
Yes.
Right. So on top of the old court, the old Bailey, the criminal courts of justice in London, the lady justice that's on top of there is not blindfolded. Her sword is above her head, and her scales are about arm's length, not raised. So there's no illusion that justice is meant to be blind. There's no illusion that it's not more of a deterrent or sword held high kind of thing. And justice is, you know, in terms of the scales, is in a very different body position to even our vision of Lady Justice.
It's interesting to me because we have a lot of fans from the UK, a lot of listeners, and a lot of listeners from all over who seem fascinated with the American justice system. And do you have any insight into what that fascination comes from?
TV.
Oh, okay. Well, there's that.
And it
mentioned that you actually use Undisclosed as a teaching aid in these in some of these classes. I don't know if you used it in England.
Yeah, you did.
I did. So in my Miscarriages of Justice class, which was to American law students who were studying abroad, so they would be second and third year of law school, I used my client's murder appeal case as a UK example. We examined the UK system, and then we also examined different U.S. miscarriages of justice. And so Adnan Syed was one of the ones we focused on, as well as Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. And we did a lot of exploration of various flaws, be it in the system, different procedural things, like what contributes to it. And always in that class was the starting question of, what is justice? So before you can decide what a miscarriage of justice is what is the justice?
Well, also, we as Americans have to decide, since very often the justice doesn't, you can't bring somebody back to life who's been murdered. You know, you can't, take back the assault from somebody who's been assaulted. You know, you can't stop those things. And when we put somebody away, are we trying to punish them or rehabilitate them? We have to make those decisions. Did you find a substantial difference between the UK students of yours and the ones in the United States?
Yes. quite a bit, and it has a lot to do with the educational system. So as a rule, they're always younger because the British undergraduate degree is only 3 years. So if you kind of assume that you're roughly 18, you've done 3 years. So my law students were about 20, 21. And so that's quite different for American law students who have to do a 4-year degree, and then law school is a bit later. Some do master's first. And so the relative age of students is different, which changes their perspective and outlooks quite a bit.
But what would you say the British outlook is?
Well, it's kind of as it's historically been. It's like a stiff upper lip. Like, the system is what it is. Like, you just kind of take it as it's given and, you know, keep calm and carry on. I think that has a lot to do with us being an upstart nation who went away from England and decided to do our own thing. Like, we're always questioning. We're always, why? Like, I would say that American students and American intellectuals are kind of like toddlers. Why? Why? Explain this. Whereas I think the British outlook doesn't really question the why. It's just, it's the way it's always been. Case in point is when I go to court, in the Crown courts, you have to wear a wig and gown. Because you always have.
You always have. There's no reason for it. It looks a little imposing.
It might have been one historically, but yeah. I cannot explain in 2017, other than tradition, why I need to put a wig on my head.
Mm-hmm. You have to wear the robes as well, correct?
So there's a black robe and white bands and black robe, white bands, and curly little wig.
Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, any country that still has a monarchy, to them, the value of simply having an institution that represents them as a nation that doesn't necessarily that has authority, but not necessarily power. I think that seems a part of British character of, you know, and by the way, there's plenty of Brits who don't think they should have a monarchy and, you know, and don't agree with that at all. But it seems like, you know, there's still a majority that that have a constant cultural expectation of a respect for the basic authority of the nation.
And I would say that that spills into exactly what you said, into the courts. It's a respect for the courts. It's a respect for the system. And the integrity of the system is above individual rights. As an absolute broad generalization, that pretty much hits the nail on the head. So to the extent that my client, the one that I mentioned, Joe, I call him Joe, but his name is Joseph Jones, he, as an individual, was not allowed an appeal on the grounds that he should have told the truth at his first trial, right? So the system says, well, you're not getting a second chance, no second bite at the cherry. But as an individual, there's evidence that he was not where he was convicted of being, period. Mm-hmm. Provided by the prosecution, conceded by the prosecution, pretty uncontroverted. But the issue is, we're not going to let you use our system and our courts this way. So you have a young man who had no prior arrests or convictions, who is serving a 33-year sentence for something he hasn't done as charged. I mean, so the case presented at trial is not true. But because they're saying, well, you knew where you were and you didn't tell the truth, well, you don't get to have the second chance now. You had your chance.
I had a very interesting interaction with British Telecom that was very similar many years ago. I was there. I was in England shooting a movie and getting them to install a phone. This is when it was still a nationalized service. Getting them to install a phone was a nightmare. It took weeks and weeks and weeks. Finally, they put one in, but they didn't leave me the number to give to people to call me. So I called them up. And I said, what is this number that I'm calling from? And they would not tell me because they said I should have asked the man when he brought the phone. And I thought, well, sure. But now I'm sorry to make light of this, but in the States here, and especially on the show, we've often bemoaned the attitude of procedure over substance, you know, in the court system, that, you know, that the process is more important to us than necessarily the facts. And obviously, it sounds like the British have their own sort of equivalent of that.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, John, that we're mentioning this, because in the two U.S. jurisdictions where Candace practiced, and we've covered some cases, most jurisdictions allow for DNA testing. I think all jurisdictions allow for it, but there are a handful, including Pennsylvania and Maryland, that say, if you pleaded guilty or nolo contendere or even had an Alford plea, you can't petition for DNA testing. And actually, I just saw on Twitter that Maryland, the legislature, now is debating making a change to that law. I'm actually writing a law review article on this very subject. But yeah, most jurisdictions are unlike the UK, as was just mentioned, where in some cases you can't bring an appeal if you're contradicting what you said at trial. Most instances in the U.S., if there's DNA evidence and that could prove your innocence, you're allowed to go forward. But Maryland and Pennsylvania are two holdouts that don't allow for that to take place.
Clearly, I have a theme from Pennsylvania to Maryland to the UK.
Yes. Well, I wanted to get back to the Chester Holman case. Do you have any first impressions of the case?
I do. I think that it is. There's always inconsistencies, but to me, there are reasons that it seems rather prosecutable and seemingly sound on its face.
Yes. A lot of people commented on that after the first episode. People were like, yeah, he said, sure. So I can totally see why police officers would pursue that case. Obviously, it gets more complicated when it's charged that, one of the police officers, punched Chester Holman first thing when he started the interrogation. By the way, Colin, can I ask where is that just from Chester's story of that particular encounter?
Right. Exactly. That is his story that we're putting forward as to what happened.
Gotcha. And there's been no particular investigation into whether or not that occurred.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So I could see why, if I was a police officer in that particular situation and I found a Chevy Blazer that had a very similar license plate, I would have assumed the same thing that I'm sure the police officers assumed. You know, this was back in 1991 in Philadelphia. So it was before you were there. Had you lived in Philadelphia before that at all?
I had not, no. So I moved from law school to Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So
I'm not a Philly native, but I will say, if you will allow me, a gratuitous E-H-E-L-E-S equals.
Okay. Yes, you're allowed. I mean, you can't. That first Super Bowl win changes everything, so congratulations, Eagles. And the city of Philadelphia. I think a lot of things are looking up for the city of Philadelphia. So but I wanted to bring up in the case of there's a particular detective involved in this one, Jeff Pyre, who was interviewed and referred to very colorfully in this last episode of Undisclosed. And my understanding was all the witness statements were taken by him. At least we certainly know Chester's was. Colin, do you know if Deirdre's was as well?
I believe I'd have to check, but I'm pretty sure it was.
Yeah. So my question is, you're setting up a situation where if there's only one police officer in the room with the person who's being interrogated, there's always going to be if you're not recording it, there's always going to be a question of what was truthfully said in that particular thing. Now, my understanding is in the British system, there are some differences in terms of how they interrogate people, but I don't know how recently a lot of those things were instituted.
What do you mean, how differently they interrogate people?
Well, my understanding is like they don't use the Reed technique, which a lot of police officers use here, which, as we've seen, can in some cases lead to false confessions. I don't know if they, a lot of people are trying to get some reform where lineups are being need to be done in a different manner so that, the police officer who supervises it doesn't know who the actual suspect is, things like that. I don't know if any of those things have been actually instituted in Britain or not.
Well, they have. So there are definitely different ID procedures. The interrogations are they're often different. So I think that one of the things to note about British policing is that it also tends to occur at a different stage. You are allowed to arrest somebody for the purpose of investigation. Your interviews are often to develop evidence, and it may be on suspicion. It's a lower standard for arrest and interviews. So here, you have to have probable cause before you arrest. So it's a higher standard before the person is brought in. Whereas there, it's different. So the interviews are invariably a different style and tone because there's often less evidence, and the evidence is derived sometimes from the interview, if that makes any sense.
Okay. So, but how is it derived? I mean, is it taken as
you ask questions or you? Okay. It itself is more of a tool. So it's more fact finding. Mm-hmm. So it's to gather information. Sometimes interviews, if they are just confirming someone's statement or it's fairly far down the line, you have a different tone. But the other thing that's driving their interviews versus the U.S. is that if you refuse to answer their questions, that can be used against you as guilt. So while it is a different procedure and defendants or suspects or arrestees are entitled to a solicitor or a representative at the police station, which I did all the time, my function there was to often tell them, you have to answer their questions or prepare to just plead guilty when you get to court.
Wow. Okay, that's a stark choice. Do you feel like
it
that—
It is. I mean, and so I think it's coercive. I think it's coercive in a non-strong-armed way. So some of the tactics, I guess, that the U.S. is criticized for, which is— it's pressuring people, but there, the pressure is systemic. It is by law. If you don't speak, well, then I can infer your guilt because an innocent person would tell me the truth. So if you're not going to say anything, then you must be guilty.
Do they have the right to counsel right away?
Mm-hmm. In the police
station. Yeah, so that's the same thing.
But it's very routine. And I often, I was also, in addition to having higher rights, I was what's called a duty solicitor. So a duty solicitor is essentially a solicitor who's on duty. And if an unrepresented person is in the police station and asks, you just kind of get called up sometimes in the middle of the night saying this person has asked for a lawyer. And I say, they're entitled to sleeping time. Can I come in the morning? So it's a little bit of a joke. But that's true. Like, I mean, they are entitled to sleeping time, and typically it wasn't urgent, and due to shift changes, I would often get called in the middle of the night, take the information from the client, tell them, don't talk to anyone until I get there, then go to the police station, explain to them, you would get initial disclosure from the police officer who isn't required to tell you everything, tell you a little bit about why they've been arrested and what they want to ask your client. Then you go talk to your client, and if they are absolutely guilty, you can say, well, don't say anything worse because you'll make it worse for yourself. But if you have any kind of a defense or anything to say or any kind of a denial, you have to offer it now, because if you don't, you can't just go to court and plead guilty and then offer it, because they will say, and as a matter of law, that you should have said it at the police station.
Yeah. And by the way, John, following up on that, I think we mentioned it during the Willie Vesey series, is that in 2014, Philadelphia did start recording these custodial interrogations. So at the time these cases were covering took place, they weren't recorded, and it was just what the detective had written down. And you might recall that we had Richard Leo, an expert on false confessions, on, and he said that these statements and confessions written before recording kind of look fundamentally different from those after recording. And I think that says a lot about the importance of recording. And a decent number of jurisdictions have now required recording of interrogations, not enough. And I hope in these next few years that more jurisdictions start requiring recording of these interrogations.
I think recording is incredibly important. And I think that why it didn't happen before is more or less resources and technology and availability. But you had to do it consistently. So if you had a tape, even if it was just a tape recorder, if you weren't tape recording all of them, then it would seem like, well, why didn't you record this one? So I think the practice of just writing them down was just one of consistency, because even if a tape recorder was available, you couldn't tape record everybody's all the time. And so then the selective would have potentially been a red flag in its own right, even if it wasn't intended to be that way.
Right.
I'll also say that Philadelphia, according to one of their documents, has actually adopted a double-blind sequential witness identification. So instead of, you know, the six-pack photo lineups with someone who's involved in the case, that they will have an officer or someone who's not involved show witnesses pictures one after the other, as opposed to just the six and on one page. So I think the Philadelphia Police Department is aware, as are many jurisdictions, and are coming around, because the world changes. So what police officers did in 1991 may not be acceptable here or anywhere in 2018, but that doesn't mean that what they were doing then was bad. It was just the norm for that time.
Well, I did actually want to bring that up in the context of Jeff Pyrie, the detective on this particular case, because, you know, in that article from 1970 from The New York Times, first of all, it sounds very dramatic. You know, obviously it's a journalist having a little fun. But also, you know, I remember back in 1970, there was sort of there were movies sort of glorifying the gritty cop who bent the rules. I mean, there's, you know, obviously that's a cliche that still occurs all the time. And it sounded as though he was playing that up with the journalist, either that or he's a bit of a sociopath. I don't, because, you know, one sentence it says, you know, he frisks a man if he sees him flinch when a car goes by. And he just got his arms slashed while fighting a junkie. It's like, well, maybe it's because you frisked him just because he flinched. You know, it sounds like, you know, he said he was looking for trouble. He said he deplores violence, but if it happens, he wants some of it. He just wants his portion of violence. I just want a little. If you can just cut me off a little chunk of violence for the just so I can have some for the rest of the day. You know, again, I don't, you know, he's talking with a journalist at a time.
Just a daily quota. It's okay.
Yes, exactly. Again, he's talking to a journalist, so he might be talking himself up or talking his own, you know, toughness up to some degree. But again, he's saying things that are disturbing for a police officer, you know, and you can see that if he does employ those tactics on a daily basis, he could be causing as much trouble as he's looking to stop. At least it sounds like from this, from his own words. And it calls into question when, you know, at the end of when he presented Deirdre Jones's confession and Chester supposedly said, I told that bitch to keep her mouth shut. For some reason, it seems to me, A, that's an incredibly stupid thing to say out loud. But I know I understand criminals are sometimes dumb. But B, it sounded a little, it sounded writerly. It sounded like somebody honestly making it up to me. And by the way,
that is probably the hallmark of criminal practice to be like, to not, that you will find 100 times in your career, that things that sound mm-hmm. like nobody in their right mind would slay slash do X, mm-hmm. they do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is what I found telling about that is that when you present someone with this information, Deirdre confessed, the first thing out of your mouth, whatever it is telling. She's lying. What? I don't know what she's talking about. Or I told her to like whatever it mm-hmm. is information in itself.
Well, certainly, if in fact he actually said it.
By the
way, if he actually said that, that doesn't necessarily mean he's guilty. If he told her to keep her mouth shut, that doesn't mean they did anything wrong. He might have said, you know what, keep your mouth shut, wait for a lawyer in the morning or something.
Exactly. I mean, right. And then that's subject to interpretation. I mean, you know, don't talk to police, the whole no snitching culture. I mean, that could be a general, I told you to be quiet, is not necessarily an admission of guilt on that part.
Right. And he's not following up. Yeah, he's not following up by giving a confession or saying anything incriminatory himself. So, yeah, it's important to contextualize it, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, but, and I suppose, like, for me, offering balance, he also didn't say she's lying or making it up. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, so there, if nothing followed in either direction, it'll just be a big, that's what his response was. But it's not followed up one way or the other. So it is still subject to interpretation.
Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I feel like given that, you know, cops are allowed to lie in interrogations at this point, you know, and given the propensity for that to be part of the cause of false confessions, as we've unfortunately found with all these DNA exonerations. Again, if a police officer is willing to be dishonest at that time with the person, it's hard to trust the veracity of a report by a police officer at that time, in my mind, as well. I had a question for you, Colin, actually. It's unclear to me that whether Chester knew that the Chevy Blazer may well have been stolen from the Alamo. Did he suspect that or did he have no knowledge and just didn't want to know?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough for me to say. Robbie has been the one who's been interviewing him directly. So I know that she included the language there about the fact that it might have been stolen. I'm not sure contemporaneously whether Chester is completely in the dark, whether he sort of has his head buried in the sand, whether he has some suspicions. So maybe if we have Rabia on the next one or we can clarify in the episode. I wasn't sure entirely the time frame when he might have had suspicions about the vehicle being taken unlawfully.
Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, it's not clear to me whether Deirdre or Chester actually asked for an attorney at that point. Did they? And were they told that they were unavailable, or did they just not ask?
Chester asked for an attorney. Yeah, mm-hmm. And he was not provided with an attorney during that time. Deirdre, I do not believe, asked for an attorney.
And is there no recourse for that? I mean, obviously, he never made a confession at that point, so it didn't, you know, the only statement that they used against him was, I told that bitch to keep her mouth shut at that point. But the fact that he never got one is, did that ever come up at trial?
Right, yeah, there's no recourse, yeah. So basically, it's something where he asked for an attorney, they said they were working to get one, the family, but yeah, that he was never provided with an attorney. But yeah, of course, he does not make an incriminatory statement, and therefore, that's not really grounds for any type of relief at trial. And even if Deirdre had and hadn't been provided with an attorney, there's this doctrine is going back to procedure versus substance, where it's a matter of standing. And so, for instance, if someone like Deirdre asks for an attorney, is not provided one, and then gives an incriminatory statement that incriminates Chester Holman, at his trial, where he's being prosecuted, he would not have what we call standing to be able to object to the Miranda violation based upon her not being provided with an attorney.
Now I wanted to bring up, there was a fascinating article in the Philadelphia Inquirer recently that had a pretty big bombshell piece of news that the DA's office had actually created a list of 26 police officers with a history of lying and racial bias and brutality. And the idea of keeping this list was to keep them from testifying, that this was kind of a warning to prosecutors, hey, don't use these guys. That is a pretty shocking thing. Apparently, this was compiled by the previous DA, now that Larry Krasner has taken over in Philadelphia. I have no idea how Larry Krasner is going to deal with this because it opens up just a huge can of worms. Candace, do you have any idea how a prosecutor could go about, because at some point that information has to become public, I would imagine.
So there's two bits of it. So I reviewed that article too. Characterizing it as a bombshell, I think, is one of those things in terms of spin. The idea that prosecutors or an office, again, it depends on how you view it, has identified potentially problem people or issues to stop them from testifying is clearly an effort to stop people, to protect the integrity of cases. So if you suspect that someone has an issue of some sort and you don't want them testifying, well, then you're not saying, oh, I'm willing to let this person do anything even if I know better, right? Now, what I don't know, because this police misconduct review unit that I think was set up by the previous administration is relatively new, is different to what I would have expected, which is everyone's entitled to due process. Sometimes folks end up on a list because of an allegation or it's under investigation. So if you have a heads up where there's been an internal affairs complaint or there's been some other arrest or there's some issue, like, you know, if one of the things on the list is 26 officers, is that there may be complaints, maybe their IAB, which is Internal Affairs Bureau, of lying, racial bias, or brutality. And the police department has been forthcoming and provided this list to prosecutors. And then prosecutors are saying, well, maybe I don't want to proceed. Because while it's pending, it may be substantiated and the officer's fired, which will end your case, or unsubstantiated and the person's cleared. So I don't actually find the existence of the list to be a bombshell. Also mentioned in that article is that other jurisdictions for decades have done similar things, which is why having a list of officers that you may need to check and see why they're on their list or follow up, because I think the article says, follow up with your supervisor, find out what's going on. Is it okay? Is it a no-go? Do you need to withdraw the case? I think that on a case-by-case basis, depending on what the circumstances are, is another indicia of trying to be reliable, fair, and full of integrity. Now, that I would count in the attorney realm as work product, basically your confidential things that you're compiling that are privileged and protected. The point in which it needs to become public or disclosed is when it would offer exculpatory information, which would be a Brady violation, when you have to. If there's something that you believe has to be disclosed, you still have that duty. On the flip side, if you release that list and it's unsubstantiated, then you end up in the situation Seth Williams was in by putting officers out there who alleged to have been doing something improper. They were cleared of it, and then they sued for defamation.
Got it. So you're saying it's not a bombshell, depending on the level to which that the individual cases of these 26 officers has been investigated. In other words, if they've been investigated thoroughly, then sure, it's a bombshell. If their investigations are still pending, it's not so much a bombshell.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, if there's 26, but or alternatively, imagine there's 26 officers where they've been investigated, and it could be some other issue. And this is what I'm saying, that I don't know enough about it. So I will be very clear that if there's a situation, imagine it's an officer, I don't know, like, I don't know what circumstances there are, but he's still on the police force, but is, like, essentially riding a desk until he can reach retirement for whatever reason. And you're going to say, actually, I don't want to put this person on the stand, but it's not directly linked to misconduct with the case. Well, then I still don't think it's a bombshell. What becomes a bombshell would be, you know, that this person has actually perjured themselves or planted something or done something that's directly related to the prosecution of cases, and then you conceal that. And I don't believe that that is what is suggested.
Mm-hmm.
And until that as a notion is exposed, I actually would challenge it. And what I understand about one of the people on the list, which was mentioned in an article, was mentioned by the new DA, Krasner, which is that in an unrelated case, he questioned a different officer who mentioned this officer by name, right? So again, like, that officer who has now been named would typically be entitled to the privacy. Is there any merit to that? Is this other officer just making it? What is going on with that? So I actually do think that to some extent that the sensationalizing of it is problematic in its own right. And if I may, the fact is that when I read it, I thought, oh my goodness, like, did I read this? Two things jumped out at me from this article. You mentioned 26 officers out of 6,300 Philadelphia police officers. And I had to use a calculator because I'm not good at math. That is 0.04%. So that's not widespread or systemic. And so that's where I think that the bombshell and sensationalizing kind of blows it out of proportion, because two dozen officers out of 6,300 seems pretty good to me. Right. Mm-hmm. Now,
well, I would make the argument that that's what they're aware of. You know, again, I come from New York City, where we've had issues with this forever. And we keep bringing in new police commissioners who try to clean it up, you know, and it, you know, and
sometimes it's the culture of a department. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So which I think that when you have that slant and you're like, I think there's more, which is precisely what D.A. Krasner says, which is that I think there's more. I am then bothered by the fact that it was he himself, like, not someone on his behalf, he himself, who was the actual lead attorney in those cases, who was questioning that officer who's now involved in this. And so from an outsider's perspective, I kind of feel a bit of a conflict of interest. Like, you know, I think that if this is now your target because of your previous dealings, that concerns me, as because it doesn't seem to fairly represent what is going on. And if you have 26, I mean, let's double the number and you call it 40 something, or I mean, whatever it is. But but the truth of the matter is that day after day, week after week, the vast majority of Philadelphia police officers and prosecutors protect and serve, you know, not to be too cliche about it. And so I am troubled by these broad brush sweeping things that kind of paint whole departments with a very negative light without much justification, because this particular officer, like I said, that is named, is only in it because of an answer by another accused, which wouldn't be acceptable if you were the defense lawyer. You would say, I want evidence. You can't just say one person said this, because that is actually the nature of some of your cases that you're saying are miscarriages of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And Candace, I was going to ask something too, a related question. I know there's been reporting on both sides of this issue, and I wanted your perspective as a former assistant district attorney in Philadelphia. And that is, when Larry Krasner took over, he fired, you know, a decent amount of the staff there, including several ADAs, and it was largely based upon going against them in court and believing that they had engaged in certain practices. And so on one side, people are saying, well, good, he was elected to clean house and he's throwing out what he sees as the bad apples and having new people come in who are more in line with his vision. And then there are other people who are saying it's important to have continuity and it's unfair that these ADAs lost their job. What's your take in terms of him coming in and firing a decent number of these ADAs who are currently on the job?
Well, there's so much to unpack there. Every DA knows that they are an at-will employee. So his ability to fire them is obviously he can do that. Whatever his motivations are behind that are a matter for him, right? So I'm not going to begin to speculate as to why he did it. The only thing I do know, because I was familiar with it happening because I'm still in touch with a number of people, is that for the victim's sake, for the people of Philadelphia, if there was no misconduct or bad acting by a prosecutor, to be fired on Friday when there's a homicide trial on Monday, I think is unfair to victims. That I didn't see as justifiable at all. I didn't understand why potentially you couldn't have a notice period or just, you understand, like if someone had done something wrong and it was immediately fireable, well then absolutely. But to have 31 people with pending cases, with victims in the system who had built a relationship with those DAs where the cases were ready to go the literal next business day, I did not see that as consistent with the mission of the office. And if it were later or in a different process, and I suppose, well, the counterargument to that would be, well, there'd never be a good time. Well, maybe not, but when I became familiar with it, there were cases that could have been jeopardized and had to been withdrawn because it was 31 DAs that were dismissed immediately.
Don't they have overlapping schedules, though? I mean, like they could be almost done with one case and then just starting another. So I imagine that would be very hard to untangle no matter what. Oh, wasn't the case in this instance?
So for this one, there may be the next one, but you could give notice to have someone prep. But if it's a Friday and the trial starts Monday, well, then maybe not for your next case, but, you know, at the conclusion of state versus it, or you understand, like, the truth of the matter is that, and again, personal opinion only, the way that it was handled did not seem to be respectful of the people that it would potentially impact.
Mm-hmm. Of the victims of crime who were with pending trials. Well, yeah, again, Larry Krasner's under a microscope now because there's a lot of people with a lot of expectations, and it will be fascinating to see how this shakes out.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm really glad that we have Candace on this show. We've had a lot of listeners reach out and say, look, we'd love to hear the perspective of either a prosecutor or a former prosecutor, and we've tried to get several different people on. I'm glad to have this perspective. Obviously, I don't have the insight into Philadelphia, so I can't really comment myself on the ground level. So I'm appreciative to have Candace come on and basically explain her perspective as a former prosecutor as well as a former defense attorney. I think that this lends a lot to the discussion that people can, you know, look into this more and assess what exactly is going on.
Yeah, we also need cops. If there are cops mm-hmm. out there who want to be on the show, we sincerely would love to hear from you. We don't hear enough. By the way, I still have this picture of Jeff Pyrie in like mutton chop sideburns in 1970 giving an interview to a bespectacled journalist. Okay, so we've also got some questions from social media. We've got one from Ellie Wise, who says, loved episode one. There actually is a playground around the corner of 22nd and Sansom where George Coleman supposedly was. It's still there. It's pretty urban looking, so it doesn't jump out as a playground, but it's for the elementary school. So if you can just pass that on to the undisclosed team, Colin. We got a lot of people saying there's a playground.
Yeah.
We got another one saying from Allison Tabini saying not sure you could see it into the gas station from the playground in 1991. Also, the bus stop they parked at could be literally any corner along 22nd or Chestnut where they keep spots open for the bus. So I don't think those things cast doubt on the witness. My comment, the view from LL2, obviously Susan, said there is definitely no playground there now about 22nd and Chestnut, but there is. The south side of Greenfield School is a playground, a common place to hang out. For what it's worth, great job, y'all. Other than the playground thing. we got this from Nicholas Partridge, who says, regarding prison sentencing policy, the view on this side of the Atlantic is that prison is for rehabilitation. Would you agree prison in America is more about punishment than rehab? Not suggesting it is, but I'm just asking. So, yeah, that's a question about prison in terms of and I think we got to it a little bit earlier in terms of the difference between here and in the UK. As you mentioned, Candace, that you felt that the UK seemed to have a really good handle on dealing with the mentally ill and juveniles as well. And do you feel like that rehabilitation is a big part of the UK system, or is it very secondary?
Well, it is. And I would say that the kind of structurally, there's a Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, which kind of allows convictions to be a bit like a conveyor belt, which means that after a certain period, they kind of fall off the end and they're called spent, which means that you don't have to disclose them. They can't be used against you. And I think that contributes a lot to genuine rehabilitation, because if it's relatively minor, you know that it's not going to follow you forever, where it happens here. So I think that having an actual legal provision for things to expire. I mean, obviously murder convictions aren't going anywhere, but other types of offenses tend to fall off the conveyor belt so long as you haven't reoffended. And I believe that having the hope of it becoming spent and falling off contributes to rehabilitation, because people know that they'll have a second chance, that one mistake won't define them forever. And I think that is a huge benefit to their system.
Yes, I think the American system could benefit from that greatly, because also just in terms of general prison well-being, you know, people with something to look forward to just face their day completely different. You know, I've always marveled that prisons are ever civil places, considering you've got so many people there who, you know, don't have any reason to be civil on a daily basis other than fear of authority. I think that could greatly help things here. We got something from Pamela Santere, who says, have you looked into how Pennsylvania issues plates to newly registered cars? In Connecticut, they're issued in series, with the letters staying consistent. All my friends' cars in high school began with ARF, and plates issued today begin with AL. Could explain similar plate numbers if that comes up in the episode. Colin, have you guys looked into that at all?
Yeah, that's going to be a big part of either episode 3 or episode 4. And as both of you noted, look, this looks like an open and shut case. And it's almost like Chester Holman is like in the movie My Cousin Vinny, going to the state of Alabama, where Candace is now, where it's the whole, you know, here's this mint green car and people go in the sack of suds, someone's shot and there's a mint green car leaving, and you're just claiming, well, wait, it's somebody else. And of course, in the movie, it turns out to be someone else. And we're at that point in the podcast now, we were looking at it and saying, oh, well, look, people saw this vehicle. It's the same vehicle with a similar license plate at the start. It has to be the same person. And yeah, we will definitely cover the license plate issue in either episode 3 or 4. And that's a big part of one of his claims in appeal, deals with the license plate.
By the way, very nice Fresh Prince of Bel-Air reference at the beginning of the episode. I have to say I laughed because I was like, okay, how far afield are we going to go? Are you going to be like, in the Christmas special of Alf, the da-da-da-da, you know, it's like, but it was funny because, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air made fun of driving while black, which is not, which is a real thing. You know, and they deserve some amount of credit for making light of something that, is actually important in bringing it up. Okay.
An interesting bit of trivia there is that Will Smith went to Overbrook High School in West Philadelphia. That's the same high school that Terrence Lewis from our prior series went to as well. So they both have the same alma mater in Western Philadelphia.
We got this question from Lori Claire, who says, how common are witness recantations in murder cases? Judges seem to superficially treat them like an everyday annoyance to be discarded. But are they actually that common?
Yeah, and this is something where I don't think there's any type of empirical data or reporting. I don't think it's a huge number of cases, but the statistic I found that was interesting, there's the National Registry of Exonerations. It shows everyone who's been exonerated in this country after being convicted. And what they found was that in 73% of murder exonerations that had recantations, there was also official misconduct. So what that means is you're not typically dealing with a case where it's simply someone coming in and they make an incriminatory statement and they later recant, and that is just in a vacuum and there's nothing else going on in the case. Usually these are coupled with some type of misconduct in the case. And as we previewed at the end of episode 2 of this series, you know, it looks like there might be some misconduct here that is going to be tied into, again, what we previewed there at the end of the episode, where someone seemingly is recanting their statement in the case.
In not just murder cases, but civilian witnesses, we had a phrase for it, and it happened with just staggering regularity. We said the witness is going south. So you would have a witness who gave a statement to a police officer, would come to court and say, I didn't say that. I don't remember saying that. Nope. He or she wasn't there. And the reality of that in our experience is that coming to court and having to face the person that you're telling on changes the dynamic. That civilian witnesses may well give a statement to a police officer and then in a courtroom say, when looking at the person, having their family look at them, fear of retaliation, whatever is compelling them to take it back or try, and even if it's a friend, try not to get the other person in trouble, drives it most of the time. And it happens, I'm going to say daily, not police witnesses, but civilian witnesses, all the time, assault cases, domestic violence cases, all the time.
Yeah, domestic violence is the big one, where oftentimes you'll have the spouse who makes the 911 call, and they're reporting this domestic violence. And then, you know, you can imagine for a variety of reasons, keeping the family together, financial reasons, etc., they decide they don't want to proceed with the case. And that leads to some thorny issues because there's different policies that apply. There have been some jurisdictions that try to prosecute the accuser who then refuses to testify against the abuser. And that, of course, raises a whole host of issues as well.
But that's different than a recantation. You know,
right.
a recantation is somebody who did that first step. They they testified in court and then they later said, for whatever set of reasons, that they were not truthful in that statement.
Sometimes they do, though. Because they either won't be, I mean, truly, like, I mean, and I would say that, like, typically from, say, preliminary hearings to trials or grand jury proceedings to trials. So they do, though.
Mm-hmm.
And that's after having taken, yeah, I mean, so it's not necessarily just from police station to trial, but there's often some type of other hearing, and they do regularly. Or domestic violence cases are typically very different, but imagine they went to the preliminary hearing and then they, you know, for all of those reasons, decided that they didn't want to say that at the trial, but then they're confronted with this prior statement under oath and they're like, nope, wasn't me, whatever, took it back. I was lying, made it up, someone told me to. And it happens in other types of non-domestic violent cases with shocking regularity as well.
Well, I would also imagine it would handicap the plea system because people could say they'll take a plea and, you know, that plea be accepted because on the condition that they testify against somebody, they testify against that person, they get out of jail. And then years later, they come back and say, I lied. Well, they still got out of jail. You know, you're not going to put a, you know. So I imagine that's one of the big reasons.
And that's where it gets to be a bit thorny because that person then saying after they testified, after they served their time, that are they lying, saying that they lied to help out the person who's still in jail? Or are they saying that, do you understand? Like, so even the subsequent lie can be discredited. And I think a lot of it depends on what other evidence there was. And I think that in a lot of cases where witnesses, as we say, go south or recant, they're not believed because there's other evidence.
Right. And that's, you know, we had that in the Willie Vesey case. We had that in the Jamar Huggins case. Both of those are cases where really the only witness against the defendant recants. And you see in both of those cases, the legal system is not very sympathetic in most cases to a recantation. Now, as Candace noted, what they're going to do is they're going to look at the recantation. They're going to look at the other evidence against the defendant. They're also going to look at the motivations behind the recantation, whether it matches up with other evidence. But yeah, I mean, that is a big obstacle in these cases is that, and you know, frankly, we'll see it going forward in the Chester Holman case, is that you can have multiple witnesses recant in a case, and that's still not enough for that conviction to be thrown out. And, you know, there's the perspective that you say, well, wait a second, this is enough doubt that we can't have this person continue to be locked up for the rest of their lives. But there's also the perspective of, well, wait a second, this is someone who's been convicted of taking someone's life, and we need to be careful in treading into this material and make sure that this is an innocent person before overturning what a jury found.
We've got one last question from social media. This is Mark, who asks, it seems like there were a lot of potential alibi witnesses in the apartment, like the downstairs neighbor. Was there any attempt to get their testimony?
Yeah, there was. And we have records in the case of the defense team talking to various people in the apartment. And so time pending in episodes 3 or 4, certainly in the addenda, we'll discuss the efforts in the front to contact them as alibi witnesses.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to thank you so much for being here, Candace. We truly, truly appreciate your point of view on all of this. And we'd love to have you back anytime you'd like to come.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed it. I like explaining things, and you can ask me anything you want about particularly the differences with UK and the US, and anything that I can offer any input on, I'd be happy to do so.
Well, thanks so much. Well, thank you, Colin.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Well, that is it for the addendum this week. If you feel like checking out our website, once again, it is undisclosed-podcast.com. There is a list of all of the criminal justice-related charities that we have there. I hope if you are grabbed by the spirit for a moment, you'll find a way to donate. I am donating all of my fees to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and you can help them as well at their website, innocenceprojectpa.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle, @UndisclosedPod. And send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I wanted to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, for his research, as well as Hannah McCarthy of Partners in Crime Media for audio production, Patrick Cortez, once again, for composing our addenda theme, and Methil Telhan, our project manager. Thank you so much for listening, and I can't wait to talk to you again next week.